Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 341 for August 4th of 2016, on the right track for electrification. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, welcome everybody to another episode of AutoLine After Hours. But Gary, this sure don't look like the studio.
No, it doesn't. We're basically at the Davos conference for the auto industry.
I've never heard it described that way. So tell everybody where we're at.
We're at the management briefing seminar put on by the Center for Automotive Research. And every year, people make the trek up to northern Michigan to hear information about what's going on from suppliers, OEMs, and other interested parties.
Other experts, exactly.
Exactly.
And we're, just outside of Traverse City, Michigan. And so we took the opportunity here to grab a couple of people that we love to have on the show. Michelle Krebs is with us from Auto Trader, but that's actually part of Cox Automotive,
which is Kelley Blue Book, Manheim Auto Auctions, and a whole lot of other things. So.
Yeah, and tell everybody what you do there.
I'm an analyst for Auto Trader, as well as a lot of the other brands that we have. So, a journalist by background, as you know.
Gary and I have known you forever. So, but yeah, we're going to get into some of your analysis later in the show. But we got to let everyone know our special guest today is Mary Ann Wright from JCI, Johnson Controls. And some of you out there in the audience may have seen Mary Ann on our television program, AutoLine This Week. But we've got you here for After Hours, so welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So tell the audience what you do at JCI.
So I'm responsible for industry and technology relations for Johnson Controls. And basically what I'm doing is kind of being the eyes and ears around on the technology landscape and working with our customers, the media, and our analysts to help them make sense of all this information that's coming at us around where automotive technology is going to go, what's going to work, what may not work, and the timing of it.
And I'll add, you're an engineer.
I am an engineer.
And you spent a lot of your career working on hybrids. In fact, when you were at Ford, and that's what we should say, you were at Ford before, too, you launched the first hybrid at the Ford Motor Company, Hybrid Escape.
The North American Truck of the Year in 2005.
You're not going to let us forget. So, Mary Ann, my question is, we've recently seen the EPA come out with its technical assessment report, what everybody in the industry calls the TAR, and, you know, this is the midterm review, or we're launching into the midterm review to determine it's the 2022 to 2025 CAFE standards, can the industry meet them? The reaction to the TAR from the environmental community has been, hey, this looks great, you guys are running ahead of schedule, this is easy to meet. And from the industry, we're hearing, hey, hold on a minute, this is getting tougher. So you're the perfect person to ask about this. What do you make of where the industry stands, the TAR, and where it's got to go to meet CAFE?
Well, so first, these rules were put in place in 2012 as part of an overall reduction in emissions and improvement in fuel economy. And at the time, this national program was intended that we would have harmonized emissions and fuel economy. So this technical assessment report is a collaboration between EPA NHTSA, who regulates fuel economy, CAFE, and CARB, the California Air Resources Board. And so this is really the technical assessment about the industry's ability to achieve the 173 grams per mile and the 54.5. I think what's important, one, we don't have harmonized standards, despite that being the expectation. Because what you'll see in that report, which is a mere 1,200 pages, but what you'll see...
Is that all?
That's it.
I don't like reading.
Yeah. Is that there's a view that we can meet the greenhouse gas emissions while not meeting the 54.5. And the reason for that is different methodology, different incentives around credits, carry forward, roll back, and the credit trading schemes, and what's included above the line and below the line. So there's a lot of work that has to happen between CARB and the EPA and NHTSA to really make sense, because it's really tricky for the OEMs. I also want to point out, and it wasn't in that report, from 2022 to 2025 is when the trucks really get hit with the majority of the task. Between 2016 and 2021, it was really all cars. And so we were overachieving. But what you've seen are things like Ford doing the lightweighting and engine downsizing and boosting in anticipation of these increased regs. So, you know, I think there's a lot of transparency, which I think is great. People are getting to put their voice in. But I think there's still a lot of uncertainty, John, around how we're really going to measure this and make sure that it's understood and fair and we can implement it.
So JCI makes about a third of all the batteries for automobiles produced in the world. So you guys have an interest, presumably, in hybrid technology, the electrification of the vehicle. Do you think that the regulations will be pushing the use of electrification of vehicles forward, or will the consumer stand back and say, I'm not so sure about that with $2 a gallon gas?
Well, first of all, we do sell a third of all the batteries in the world, but they're the ones that crank your engine and do start-stop, right? And those will continue to be, because even if you have an EV, you have to have a lead-acid battery to do the low-power accessories. But if you look at the report, they still say the preponderance of the vehicles in the 2022 to 2025 timeframe will be advanced internal combustion engines. So working on compression ratios, variable valve timing, they'll be doing things like multi-speed transmissions and CVTs. So their view is that EVs will be 3% or less. Hybrids, there's a very different view between NHTSA and EPA. NHTSA believes it's about 18%, which I think is way high, where the EPA, I think, is somewhere in the low single digits. And so what we believe we'll see is continuation of internal combustion diesel with a whole lot of other technologies that you're seeing the OEMs come up with now. So a lot of the things that are in vehicles today were never envisioned in those 2012 standards. So things like turbocharging, e-turbocharging, 48 volt, some of the aero technologies are being put in place. And those are doing nothing but continuing to help the cause around internal combustion engine and good old-fashioned lead-acid technology and start-stop.
Mm-hmm. Gary touched on it, and the thing that we keep looking at, because we are focused on the consumer who's shopping in the market, the consumer acceptance of these kind of things. And I think that is yet to be figured out. We certainly haven't seen them, especially with gas prices, where they are being accepting of EVs and plug-in hybrids and such in any kind of numbers. Where do you see that going, the whole consumer angle?
Well, I think you're right. So first of all, I always, and John, you and I talk about this, I don't think this is an either or, it is an and. And so plug-ins, electric vehicles, fuel cells all have a role in the portfolio, because there's a portion of the people, 3-5%, that want this kind of technology. It's important to them, it represents their values, and they want to be seen representing their values. But the majority of the people want fuel-efficient vehicles. They're not going to pay for it. They expect it, and the OEMs are delivering it to them and not asking them to compromise on any of the performance. So, for instance, they don't care if you downsize a V6 to a V4 or an inline 6 to an inline 4, as long as you give them the boost through a turbo and don't compromise any of the performance. You're getting a lot more fuel efficiency. You've taken a lot of weight out, but you haven't made them compromise on anything.
But when you get to the very stringent 2025, won't there have to be some compromises? And that's where I see consumers maybe not willing to go there. Will there be so much compromise to get to those that there then it becomes a issue around consumer acceptance?
Well, so there will be electric vehicles in that time frame, but it's still going to be a very small portion of the mix. And again, this is where we have to go through this midterm review. The fact is, the fuel economy will not reach 54.5. It never was going to be 54.5. Now, we got pretty close to about 51 on an emission side, but that's, again, as you look at what do you include above or below the label, so it's much more complex than we have time for here. But when you look at consumer adoption in face of $2 gasoline and no signs that it's going to go higher, the regulations are not going to drive consumer behavior. I think the wild card here continues to be the California and the other green states that are mandating certain levels of electrification. The issue that they're running into is a couple of things. One, the cost, consumer acceptance, infrastructure, as well as if you look at the credit scheme that's out there now, and I don't mean scheme in a bad way, but the credit philosophy, that would only represent, instead of 3.5 million vehicles that they want on the roads, about 2 million because of all the credit trading that's going on. And so clearly some work needs to be done on the credit side. But there's so many technologies out there, Michelle, that can get us darn close to that 54.5, such as 48 volt, that aren't going to ask the customer to spend a lot of money, but will give them the value and the performance that they
expect.
So
you touched on one. It doesn't come free, though, and we're already seeing an affordability crunch with car buying. How much money does that add to vehicles?
What's this technology going to cost?
So the EPA and NHTSA, and they vary because, again, but anywhere from, they're saying from $800 up to about $1,600. Now, that's a whole lot of assumptions in there. But what it tells you is they aren't counting on a lot of electric vehicles. It really is going to be fundamental improvements in engine technologies and things that we mentioned previously, transmission, CVTs. I think 5 or 6 years ago it was about 8%. It's up to 20%. They're beautiful. And the way they've tuned them, the performance is excellent. You're going to see a lot of investments around aero and lightweighting. And so that's why you see the add-on cost is not this shocking $5,000, $15,000 that perhaps people thought it was going to be when you were looking at a mass adoption of electric vehicles.
Are there ramifications? JCI is a global company, so you're looking at what's going on in the rest of the world. And as we see, the European Union with their grams per kilometer traveled regulations, the Chinese are beginning to implement some more restrictive requirements. How do you see this all playing out for global auto manufacturers as they're looking at these various markets?
Well, Europe continues to be the leader in environmental standards implementation.
You think? I'm not so sure they are. It seems to me, you look at all these defeat devices that are legal to use. They're testing procedures that are easy breezy. I don't buy the argument that Europe, they talk the game. But when you look at their regulations and results, I don't think it's that great.
So the law is the most stringent. The implementation, I will give you, there, we could have a really interesting conversation about that, but their law is, in fact, the most stringent in terms, and it's focused on carbon emission reduction. Mm-hmm. And so what you're seeing is the majority of new technologies are coming out of Europe and then follow on in the U.S. and in China. You're right, John. The intent needs to be something that represents real-world performance, and I think one of the things that Europe has done is they're transitioning to a new drive cycle for their certification. And this drive cycle turns upside down assumptions around what technologies would be winners and losers in the previous way we measured it. They're also looking at, I think it's called RWE, real world emissions, which is actually going to be measuring in-use emissions for exactly the kinds of things that we get it out the back end of the plant and we certify to this, but over time, are we maintaining that performance? And one of the things that we are very big proponents of is start-stop. Start-stop is a really, it's just like a no-nonsense kind of technology. The engine doesn't run except for when it's needed. Now, and so you get certified with that. Over time, however, just because of wear and tear on the vehicle and degradation of systems, that starting and stopping function starts to degrade. So this RWE proposed would start informing customers that, hey, you are not saving as much fuel or you're not saving the emissions that you originally did, and it's time to start replacing some of your systems so that we maintain that level of performance around fuel reduction and emissions reduction.
We talked earlier about consumer acceptance. Michelle brought that up. What do you think about consumer acceptance of start-stop? I can't believe how many people hate it. It doesn't bother me at all. Some systems are better than others. In fact, I just got out of a couple of GM products, Cadillac and Chevrolet. I thought it was as seamless as you can get. But as you know, on some of the high-end cars, BMW notably, there's a button where you can turn it off.
Yeah.
And that was customer feedback. They hate the thing. I've talked to chauffeurs, especially in Europe. They despise it. So is the public going to accept start-stop enough that you can really make a difference with it?
They're not going to have a choice, are they?
Yeah, and so, John, this is, you and I, will we can disagree forever, but actually, in Europe, I would agree with you that when it first came out, what you just said is exactly true. But if you look at consumer acceptance now, it's upwards of 80% of people who do not touch that button. I'm glad to hear that. I had not heard that before. Yeah. So, and we have data that shows, and you know, we're doing fleet testing, and we work with all our customers. So I think people have gotten over that. One, there's the first systems were rough. The pull-ups were rough, and it was very noticeable, and it didn't inspire confidence. But all of the OEMs, and you mentioned too, GM has done it flawlessly. Ford on the Fusion and the F-150 are absolutely beautifully executed. You go to the German OEMs now, they've done a tremendous amount of work to make this very seamless and not compromise even on the creature comforts as well. And so, you know, 80% of the new vehicle market in Europe will be start-stop in 2020. 50% here. And Ford has announced that they're going to put it across everything with EcoBoost, which is across their lineup. GM's going to do it 100% across the board because it's inexpensive technology that actually really does save fuel.
I think a little consumer education would be helpful. I mean, I ran into a woman in a parking lot who couldn't get her brand new car started again, and I had to, okay, put your foot on the pedal. So I think education would help probably.
It's a huge enabler.
You know, it's interesting that the F-150 having start-stop and everybody's looking, ooh, the aluminum. And it's the technology like start-stop that is helping that car, truck, I mean, get good performance.
Right.
And I think that's something that's unfortunately overlooked.
Well, I think that's a really good point, Gary. And if you look at what Ford did, they took some big risks on the flagship of the company. 700 pounds out of that vehicle. They downsized an engine and put a turbo in, and the customers love it. And I'll go back to this fuel efficiency because, John, you're right. People buy a vehicle because of the utility or the mobility needs or their personal needs that they want in a vehicle. All things being equal, they want it to be fuel efficient because they don't want to go to the gas station, and they do look at their operating costs. And so when you look at an F-Series is a perfect example where they did all this lightweighting, and you know, by downsizing an engine, it's anywhere from 50 to 125 pounds. That's 11 to 20% fuel economy opportunity. That's gold right there. And you didn't ask the customer to compromise on anything. And that's why, Michelle, going back to your comment around people pushing back on EVs, that's a perfect example where you can have great technologies that allow people to drive the things that they want to drive, get the fuel efficiency, reduce their operating costs, and don't ask me to do anything different in my behaviors.
You've talked about 48-volt hybrids, not a strong hybrid like a Prius is, but something to step down from that. Do you think that's the sort of seamless technology that people may be getting in their cars in the future, not even know it's really a hybrid, and that's the solution that the industry needs to go to?
Oh, I think it's definitely going to be like the next breakthrough, and I think there's going to be some other technologies that will be enabled because of it. So when you think about all of the assisted drive features and functions, the migration of traditionally mechanical loads to electrics, those are huge power consumers. And our 12-volt power net is getting filled up. And so we're doing things like adding a small lithium-ion battery to get some more power capability, some regen, or some more fuel. But you're going to reach a point where the 12-volt just won't do it. And that's why the 48-volt is so attractive. You got to stay below 60 so you don't electrocute people. And so 48, here's your science lesson. You stay at 48 volts because you get spikes, and as long as you stay below 60, you're good. And what that does is you don't have to have big, heavy orange cabling. You don't have to have high voltage isolation. You don't have to have all the multi-point failure redundancy protection against the customer. So what does that do? It makes it smaller, cheaper, lighter, and delivers the same kinds of performance that you see in today's hybrids, which I think hybrids going forward are going to be very challenged, John, because you can virtually drop these solutions in. The OEM can package the battery wherever they want. They're going to upsize the motor, and they probably are going to downsize the the internal combustion engine and replace it with a turbo. I think the next, here's my prediction, John. So
right.
In 5 years, we
Trump
get to
roll,
see.
Please.
Is going to be e-turbos and e-boosters. And you and I have talked about 20 years ago how awful turbochargers were. Lag, they didn't, you know, they just.
They were like light switches.
They were
on and off.
They were terrible. Now, one is good, two is good. We have some vehicles that have four, which has allowed the OEMs to downsize their engines, get a lot of weight out, and supplement the performance, and in fact, in many cases, perform or improve the performance. With 48-volt, you actually enable e-boosting, which I think is going to be the next big technology breakthrough.
So you'll actually use the energy from the battery to spool up the turbo?
Well, that or through the motor generator, mm-hmm. Depending upon how they distribute the loads. But you're going to need that to power it.
But to the issue of 48-volt, I mean, I think if we were at this conference 10 years ago, there were probably half a dozen speeches about 48-volt, and it's still just coming along. I mean, are we at some inflection point now that we're going to have changes and people are actually going to have a different electrical architecture?
Yeah, I think what the inflection point is, you sat in on the session yesterday on autonomous driving.
Right.
That's going to require so many more sensors and computers. And there are things like what BMW did on the 2017 7 Series with the adaptive suspension. These all are huge power consumers that we just simply can't continue to support on the 12-volt power net. And I think that's what's different. But, Gary, I think that's an excellent point, is that this continued evolution of really good technology continues to push out things like hybrids, electric vehicles, and 10 years ago pushed out 48-volt because you could still get that efficiency. But we're at an inflection point where if you want to be able to get to that next, weight class or really get weight down, you're going to have to electrify systems, and that's going to require a higher power net.
My understanding is that a strong hybrid, a la Prius, a la the vehicle you launched,
yeah.
The Hybrid Escape, added about $2,500 to $3,000 cost to a car. Is that about right? And what would a 48-volt system add to the cost?
So I think it's about $2,500 to $3,000 now. 10 years ago, it was
a whole lot more?
Four or five times that, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's really thanks to all the technology advancements. In fact, a lot of the technology that we've put on those hybrids, now you find E-Pass, brake-by-wire. So you're seeing that on what we call the more traditional vehicles. So the cost of a 48-volt is in the $1,000 to $1,200.
Mm-hmm.
So 15% better fuel economy for about $1,200, which is, if you compare that to a mild hybrid today, which is about 15%, where you have $3,000 or $4,000 on cost, is a pretty good buy. And, oh, by the way, you aren't building your vehicle around a heavy battery, all those much bigger motors and all the controllers.
Like you said, you just drop it in.
You drop it in, and it's really a much more elegant, simple solution where you focus on delivering performance versus building the shielding all around it because of the high voltage system.
But it's using a lithium ion battery.
Yeah, so you take an AGM, which is our start-stop, and you size it for the application, and then you pair it up with a small, same size as what you have for your starter battery. You put in probably a 10 or 12 kilowatt motor and a hybrid controller, and you're about done. A DC to DC, because you need to step the voltage between 12 and 48 volts.
So you could do it on an existing, it doesn't have to be from a brand new vehicle, you could do it in an existing chassis kind of thing.
Yeah, so Audi,
yeah,
that's exactly right, Michelle. So a good example, Audi will be launching the first 48 volt later this year. I think it's on the Q7, which is their flagship SUV that was just redesigned, and it's a drop-in option for that particular powertrain.
So do you think that this is going to be the enabler for the OEMs to meet the 2025 requirements by sticking with internal combustion engines but supplementing it in a useful way?
Yes, I think that it will. This is going to be a really good technology. Now, it will be adopted first in Europe, John, because they need it for the rules. I won't debate on how they're going to implement it, but they'll need it for the rules. So you'll see it first in the luxury German. It will come over here, and then it will get adopted on the platforms where it makes sense. But Gary, I want to be very clear. the majority of what you're going to see in the 2025 is still going to be advanced gas, which is all the technologies that the OEMs are working on. And in fact, Argonne National Laboratory is still saying there's 20 to 30% more efficiency coming out of the internal combustion engine, paired up with all this great transmission technology, aerodynamics, light weighting, then pair it up with start-stop, advanced 12 volt, which is a small lithium ion, and then a 48 volt. So they have a lot of levers that they can pull without having to do a lot of the EVs, which there's going to continue to be, I think, a lack of willingness.
Although some are talking about, we're going to see a 200-mile range EV, mm-hmm. affordable, as opposed to the expensive Tesla S with the Chevy Bolt and ultimately the Tesla Model 3.
Right.
Some are saying that they think around 2022 might be the turning point for EVs. What do you think? In terms of consumer acceptance,
We believe, and I share the view that EVs have a role, but they're going to be 3 to 5% of the market. Now, that's not a small, business proposition. But the issue that you have, you can't drive scale with these EVs. Every one of them is a one-off, because the battery has to be packaged in a special place, which means you can't standardize the energy storage. The motor sizing, the way they design all of the controllers. And so without having standardization, it's a really difficult business proposition to drive scale and cost down. And that's the beauty of, I'll go back to the 48 volt. This battery is the same size as what you have in your battery today. So you can package it in the wheel well if you want to, for weight balance. You can put it under the seat. You can put it in the center console. You can put it up under the hood. So it's drop-in wherever they have room. You aren't building a vehicle around a powertrain technology, which I think is really important to the whole notion of affordability and consumer acceptance.
Can I add, when you talked about scale and volume, is China, the key to the tipping point for this? Where does China stand in all of this?
China has set their fuel consumption rules through 2021. They're becoming huge adopters of start-stop, and they'll be 50% by 2021. We absolutely see a lot of interest in this 48-volt. They have not been able, just like everyone else, they haven't been able to break that over that challenge of mass adoption of EVs yet because of the
even
cost.
With massive incentives.
Even with that, you haven't anywhere because you still have the infrastructure and you still have the compromises. So 48 volt in China is for sure going to be one of the solutions.
We were talking about Europe driving technology forward, and Volkswagen made the announcement of 30 electric vehicles being launched within the next 10 years, which, here is a company that, for good or ill, was characterized as being associated with diesel technology. But now here they are going with all these EVs and have actually created a modular architecture so they will be able to build a variety of vehicles. Do you think that that's going to have an impact, or will that still just sort of be a sideshow to the main business of Volkswagen?
Well, so despite the unfortunate event with Volkswagen, diesels are a great technology, and I don't think we in the industry will give up on diesels because they are really good. I was talking to one of my colleagues at an OEM, and he said something I think is spot on. And he said, we are going to see an absolute proliferation of nameplates for EVs with no volume.
Wow.
And I think he's right. And because it will be part of the portfolio, it will not be the predominant volume driver of the portfolio for all the things that we've been talking about, because there are just so many things that the OEMs can do that the consumers are willing to accept and give and deliver the value that they expect.
Also, I think it's important to make sure we know the definition. Is Volkswagen talking about, what did you say, 20 or
30?
30.
Electrification
pure
or
battery
EV.
Electric,
yeah, exactly.
Or are you talking electrified vehicles? Because if you talk electrification, i.e. 48-volt system like you're talking about, Marianne, I do believe it's going to become very widespread. In fact, as I said earlier, I think people will have a hybrid and not even know that they have a hybrid.
Right.
And I think that is actually the way to make it happen. In fact, it's very interesting to see how GM is approaching it. I mentioned stop-start. I was in the Malibu hybrid.
Right.
The only way you know it's a hybrid is on the back end, there's a little blue H.
Yes.
And other than that, you don't know.
Can't tell.
And I think they may be on to something, that maybe one of the things that helped the Prius early on is it looked very different. Mm-hmm. And people who were motivated to buy a hybrid and wanted to show everybody they were driving something different. But maybe for the general public, the mass public, that's not the way to go. So I think GM might, we'll see. We'll see how the sales of this thing go yet. It's too early. It just came out to really say, here's the trend. But I wonder if that's the way to do it.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, people want, they want performance, they want value, and they want their vehicle to represent their personalities or the utility that they need. And so I think in terms of when it comes to electrification, just give it to me, and give it to me at a price that makes sense for me, and don't make me compromise.
And I would add to the compromise, I don't think they want to change their whole lifestyle around the vehicle. Oh, they want convenience,
absolutely.
They want time saving.
But it comes down to, you know, you're talking about you have to educate people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when I come home and I have a hybrid and my neighbor will say, where do you plug it in? I'm like, no, you just put gasoline in it. Right. It's just like, well, but where's the plug?
People don't
There's
know.
A lot of education on all these technologies to be done, I
there
think.
There absolutely is. And in fact, on the plugging, the press over the last couple of weeks has been, hey, if you go to plug in your electric vehicle, you may not be able to do it because we don't have a standard on the plugs. And they said, well, that's probably okay because everybody's going to charge at home. But that gives you another indication that there's a lot of stuff that still needs to be sorted out.
Mm-hmm. Marianne, we got to wrap up the segment with you, but it is so great that we were had the opportunity
thank
here
you.
At the conference to get you to join us
well,
today.
Well, thank you, and it's really good to see all of you as
thank
well.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Great discussion. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment. Got to give a shout out to our friends who sponsor this show.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Well, we're back from the break. In fact, the conference is taking a break, so we've got a whole bunch of people milling about us right now. But even though we've come up to Northern Michigan, to Traverse City, to the MBS conference, Dr. Data is here with his number.
All right. So the number is zero, and it's zero in 2020. What is it?
Zero in 2020.
Does it have to do with fuel economy?
Ish.
Advanced electric vehicles?
No.
Okay.
All right.
I'm going to guess that Gary is saying there will be zero autonomous cars in 2020.
No, actually, there will be zero cars, trucks, buses, or taxis operating on Oxford Street in London in 2020. So here is a major, major street in the city of London, shopping street. If you go there, I mean, you see the theaters and the shops and the stores and the restaurants. And because of the fact that in the first week of the first month of the year, it broke the full year requirement for emissions on that street, they measured it, that they've decided by 2020 to ban it. Now, the problem is they don't know where the traffic's going to go.
Yeah, you're just shoving the traffic somewhere else,
right? Yeah.
So Oxford Street, go and breathe there, but don't go
That's
three
right.
blocks away.
Oh, by the way, the air doesn't just kind of...
Right. But, I mean, it's pretty incredible that they're going to, you know, completely ban it. Now, cars right now are banned from Oxford Street during peak hours and on weekends. But across the board, so those nice double-decker buses.
I wonder if there will be other cities at that point that...
But will they allow, say, quote-unquote, zero-emission vehicles to go in there? Or
it's,
they,
not clear.
It's not clear. Interesting. I think this is going to be a growing trend, particularly in Europe, starting in Europe, but I think it'll spread worldwide. Look, parts of Times Square you can't drive through in New York City, mm-hmm. so it's even happened here to a degree. But, yeah, when you ban traffic and it brings out the pedestrians, I mean... People love to get out and walk around.
Right.
Store owners actually love it because there's so much foot traffic that increases in the area. I think this is a growing
trend.
And
people can breathe.
Yeah.
hey, you know, a side benefit.
Uh-huh. Michelle, you said you had a number,
well,
too.
You know, we're here at this conference, and the big topic is, has the auto industry peaked? And we just heard some amazingly different forecasts, one end of the spectrum of the other. So I will throw out a number, 57%.
57%.
Truck sales?
Car sales.
Truck sales?
Nope.
So...
You're not going to get it.
The car-truck mix will be 57?
It's already 60-40.
Oh, it's already 60-40.
So, okay. No, 57% of people tell us the reason they aren't buying a car, they cannot afford a car. And we think the car sales should be way higher based on the population.
Right.
But there's a serious affordability problem. And as we talked in the earlier part of the show, I'm not convinced all this technology doesn't add a lot of cost that... to the vehicle, and that becomes even more of a problem because wages aren't keeping.
Well, but to your point, I mean, we heard Sean McElinden, who is the chief economist for CAR, which is the organizer of this, say that the average loan is 66 months.
By our account, it's 68. And
that's
climbing.
Average?
Average. And he said 29%.
We're over 72.
72.
That's a lot.
And because that's how people were keeping the monthly payments down.
Right.
But what we know is when you're, the longer you're in a vehicle, your life changes, you want a different vehicle, you are stuck because you're upside down.
Okay.
They may last that long.
And upside
but
down
you don't
meaning
want that.
That you owe
can't
more
afford
on the car
exactly.
than what the car is
exactly.
Worth.
And then you become more disloyal to that brand and that make. And
okay, so here's a question I have for you, Michelle. So because of this affordability issue, how do we explain that small cars and sedans are just plummeting while the price, you know,
easy, easy explanation. They can't even afford to get into those. We haven't done the analysis. I'm asking our people to do that. But I suspect small car sales and mid-sized car sales wouldn't, I don't think it's just about choice for SUVs. I think that that part of the market has been mostly affected by the affordability issue. So I think we'd be selling more of those if it wasn't an affordability issue, if, you know, wages were keeping pace with the price of cars and the price of other things. I mean, if you look at the data around what people are spending on housing and all kinds of other things, that has skyrocketed compared to wages.
Well, you got a great point, because if you look at historically in the U.S., and I know the stats, is that about 5% of the population goes out and buys a new car every year, on average. In recession years, it drops down. It can go down to 4%. In good times, like we saw certainly last year, even this year, it should be up at around over 6%.
Mm-hmm.
And if we held to that same rule of thumb, the SAR shouldn't be 17 to 18 million. It should be 22 million.
Yes.
If you look at the number of people, or the percentage of the population that bought cars in the year 2000,
yes,
not all that long ago, the SAR today should be 22 million.
So here's another stat exactly on that. In the year 2000, we sold 17.5 million cars. Last year was about the same. Population of drivers is up 38 million. We have a ratio of, for every 12 people, every 14 people, there was a new car now. 12 to 1 at that time before. So, and we looked at things like, is it urbanization? Is it millennials not being in the market? Those aren't the factors that we see. It's the affordability.
So, I mean, what is the extent to which the affordability issue is driven by technologies needed to meet fuel economy regulations versus just having stuff in your car? Okay, having all kinds of new technologies. And I, you know, I think that, you know, consumers saying, wow, I can get this, I can get this, I can get this,
yeah.
I can get this. And they buy it, and it just drives up the cost of vehicles.
Those who can afford it buy it.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the others aren't even
But I mean,
in
there are a lot of cars out there that you can buy for under $20,000. I mean, easy, right? I mean, you can just go out there and you know, buy a Chevy or buy a Hyundai and not spend a whole lot of money. Yet, what is the average transaction price? It's like
34,000.
Yeah.
And the average income is 54,000.
Right.
But the median income of people buying new cars is household income is $75,000.
Exactly.
So you're absolutely right. There's a big gap, and the problem is wages have stagnated.
Exactly.
For the middle class, wages have flatlined for almost two decades now.
Right. And really accelerated. The gap is accelerated in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Although there is some evidence that it's starting to come back a little bit now.
Exactly. You know, and Sean talked about that this morning. That you know, employment or maybe the GM economist talked about employment being better. Then we got to see the wages get better.
Yeah.
It's something we're really looking at closely.
So what do you see going forward? Now chief economist for General Motors spoke this morning, and he said it's going to continue
to keep going.
You know, cheap gas, there is full employment and full, you know, low interest rates will keep sales going up. Sean, on the other hand,
disaster.
Came out there and said, yeah,
the chief economist for the car group.
Right. We could lose 29% of sales. It could go down to 15 again, and we could lose all kinds of jobs. I guess somewhere in the middle is the truth. We think we're off the peak. We are thinking it's really too close to call. If this year will be a record, it's going to be so close. But we are seeing interest.
Do we have to set new records every year for the industry to be healthy?
Well, but that's the problem. We start seeing unhealthy practices, and we're already seeing higher incentives, inventories climbing. The rental car issue, we're seeing unhealthy practices, and that will affect profitability. So. But we don't see, we're not clear on how deep the dip will be or how long. We don't think it's going to be that dramatic. We still think we're going to be in the 17s, millions.
Yeah. Which I still think is a healthy level. And I got to tell you, I've talked to, and I've said this before, several supplier CEOs who have said, boy, I'd actually like the market to slow down a little bit because we're running so much overtime, we're doing so much expedited shipping, i.e. having to fly parts to an assembly plant to keep the line running. And anytime you put something on an airplane, wow, your costs go through the roof. So they're actually saying that if things slow down a little bit, they'd actually be more profitable.
A little more breathing room. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But one assumes that if you're running an auto company, you want to have bragging rights about how you've increased car sales and truck sales month after month.
Certainly for stock market. I mean, look what happened to Ford when they said things are slowing and their stock just took a nosedive. Yeah, and there's always this pressure to up, up, up. And that's not necessarily the healthiest. I think it's interesting in the last few years we've seen much more focus on profit margins by manufacturers. I never used to hear that. You know, it was always sales, market share. If you can have all three of those, that's great. But the focus on profit margin is a healthier race.
Good point. Everybody is so in the auto industry right now. They're so focused on boosting their stock price. I mean, management at these companies is under enormous pressure from Wall Street to improve their margins. And that's been the focus now of why their stocks are in the doldrums. In the past, you used to talk about, look at all the revenue, look at all the sales, and that drove the stock price. Now they're looking at margins and saying, hey, guys, you kind of stink.
Yeah, compared to other industries. They're the best we've seen in a long time.
Long time.
So as the viewers and listeners can tell me, there's a lot of excitement in this room, and you know, what are some of the subjects that you think are of key importance to the auto industry?
Well,
right
I
now?
Think you know the, and we're focused on it, and we see a lot of sessions here on achieving fuel economy, autonomous driving. Although I still think that's a ways off, but certainly driver assisted technologies. I think those are the big things of focus here.
Yeah. How about you, Gary? What did you learn?
Well, I mean, I have to echo what Michelle's talking about. I mean, we're learning a lot about materials and mixed materials and lightweighting vehicles and more clever design. And, you know, it almost seems to me that you know, it's sort of the fundamentals that they're finally getting back to. But that said, I mean, the whole issue of cybersecurity is now because of this whole autonomous driving thing. And I had a discussion with a chief scientist of a cybersecurity company yesterday that made me sort of like want to walk home from Traverse City because, I mean, it's scary stuff. And but, you know, but that said, I mean, we have this big conference going on here, and starting in Las Vegas will be the Black Hat USA and DEF CON conferences, which are the hackers. And so the two guys that did the famous pack of the Cherokee are going to be back making a presentation. That would be Charlie Miller and Chris Vlasic. And just this is the abstract of the paper that they'll be giving. In this talk, we discuss how physical safety critical systems can react to injected CAN messages, the CAN bus that every vehicle has, right? How these systems are often resilient to this type of manipulation. We'll outline new methods of CAN message injection, which can bypass many of these restrictions and demonstrate the results on the braking, steering, and acceleration systems of an automobile.
Don't you just love it when these black hats share all their information of how to hack into your car?
I mean...
Well, did you... I don't know if you guys attended that cybersecurity conference that was in Detroit last week or the week before. That was a really interesting one, and there was a lot of talk about inviting the white hats in to really test you out. And in fact, we saw Fiat Chrysler actually make a deal with one of these groups.
Yeah, no, they're starting to do it. In fact, we saw FCA put out a bounty. Hey, if you can hack in, we'll pay you money. Tesla's actually been doing that for a number of years now.
Right.
Although the last I looked on their website, nothing had been updated since 2014.
Oh.
So I don't know if they're that secure or they just aren't bragging about people being able to hack in.
Right.
But, you know, one of the interesting things that I learned was, talking about Tesla, that, we've talked on the show many times about how they have over-the-air updates that improve the performance of your vehicle. But apparently the possibility of having over-the-air updates means there's the opportunity for some bad guy to do something over-the-air. But at the same time, when they had that problem with that hack that these guys did for Wired Magazine, that their response was to send USB sticks to their customers. And the question is, okay, how many customers actually do that, right?
Yeah.
So,
what if the bad guys just decide to get their hands on a mailing list and they mail out bad thumb drives, and you're loading the malware into your car, happily thinking that you're going to protect yourself.
Right. So, I mean, it's
a complicated issue. Yeah. I'm glad I don't have to.
And it's not going
to
go away.
No. Only increase.
Yeah, absolutely. And.
The thing that I learned yesterday, I sat in on the session about autonomous and connected cars, and there's a big change that's happening right now. Heretofore, what everyone's been doing is hiring armies of coders who write zillions of lines of code trying to anticipate every different situation that an autonomous car may encounter. And, clearly Tesla didn't figure out one where a semi-block in the road might be a problem for the car. But now there's a different approach that's emerging of using artificial intelligence. They also refer to it as neural networks. They also refer to it as deep learning. I guess I learned that all three of them really are the same sort of thing. But you teach the car how to become autonomous. You don't write zillions of lines of code. You attach this, for better lack of a word, because I'm in way over my head in describing it. But you attach this artificial intelligence program to your car, and you start driving around, and now it learns how to drive. And so you have this artificial intelligence program generating lines of code instead of armies of coders doing it. And one of the guys yesterday, one of the speakers, gave an example of how they were able to teach a car to be relatively good autonomously in a matter of months. What he said would have taken them the other way a couple of years to do.
So basically, this almost sounds like trial and error, though. And, the error part would not work out so well. Like,
well, here's the other error.
You don't
part.
Want to do that. Dang.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you're learning from a bad driver.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What if the car learns bad things?
Right.
And everybody sort of scratched their head over that.
And we know
one.
There's, like, bad drivers out
right.
there.
Right. Yeah. So don't model that behavior.
Yeah. But nonetheless, they're all going to jump onto this
right.
because nobody can get the coders that they need.
Right.
Everywhere we go in this industry, there's without exception, every automaker and supplier I go to says we can't get the talent that we need. They're all stealing from each other.
Right.
So if all of a sudden you come along and say, hey, I got this artificial intelligence program, and now you don't need, 2,000 coders, everyone's going to jump onto
right.
it.
Right.
So we were talking with Marianne about fuel economy, and I was astonished. I drove up here in a Honda Civic sedan, okay? I drove reasonably close to the speed limit, and I got 41.5 miles per gallon. And I mean, the air conditioner was on.
It's not a hybrid or anything.
No, no, no. But I mean, and as Marianne was saying, it's got a small four-cylinder turbocharged engine. It's got a CVT. And, you know, I was thinking, 10 years ago, I would have had to stop at a gas station.
Oh, less than that. I remember looking online, maybe it was 2010, 2011, how many vehicles got over 40 miles to gallon? There was one. Mm-hmm. It was the smart car, which, yeah. You know.
But I mean, it was just,
now, you know, trucks get over 30 miles per gallon. And I think that is underrated as a... People always, I get a lot of media calls, oh, gas prices are keeping EV sales low. No, it's the competition from the really yes. good mm-hmm. improvements you know, in the internal combustion.
The point I always make when people say it's gas prices, I go, oh, yeah, well, in Europe, it's $7 a gallon. And we buy more electric cars than they do
right.
on a percentage basis
right.
even. So it's not that. And, you know, in China, EV sales are starting to pick up. But look at the incentives they're giving away. You can get a license plate. That saves you $18,000 right off the bat.
And not just the money, but the advantage of,
right.
of that.
Yeah. Yeah,
so it's not just gasoline prices
right.
that are keeping them low.
Yeah, speaking of gasoline prices, so last week I was not on the show because I was on vacation in Europe. And I was
I was
visiting this town, this little town, Monse, in Austria, where the Sound of Music was based. And so I'm walking through this town, and I come up to this parking lot, and there are all the various and sundry small little cars, the little Renaults, and so on and so forth. And there was a Ram 1500.
Wow.
I stopped and took a picture of it. I mean, couldn't believe this.
Man, what's that cost to bring in there?
And what does that cost for $7 per gallon, even
right.
though it is a fairly efficient vehicle?
You know, I drove up here in a Chrysler Pacifica. I averaged 27 miles to the gallon. Now, that's all highway driving. But I was going 80.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think if I slowed down to 55, it would have been 30. And for that size vehicle, I think that's extraordinary.
Right. Yeah. So it's not all about the gas prices.
No, it's not. You know, a part of it, though, is... You know, we like to have choice. We like to be able to choose what we want to choose. And, you know,
And we don't want to disrupt our lifestyle. I don't want to have to plan, I'm not going to make it to, you know, I can't imagine me being an EV driver and having to plan all my stops.
What if your EV had a 200-mile range?
That might be a different
story. Or maybe
story.
Even a 300 in the coming decade.
Right.
Would that change your mind?
Maybe.
But 200 wouldn't get you here from Detroit.
No, it would
not. And
not.
So 300 would, but then even though you might feel like, I don't know, am I just going to make it, and how comfortable
right.
are you about that?
What
you know
if
what
I mean? Wanted to do a little detour?
Yeah, that's right. And
I never want to say what somebody told me that they heard about, but somebody told me that they had heard about somebody who came up here with their Tesla S, and instead of being a roughly four-hour drive, it was a six-hour drive because of their problem
right.
of having to find out where they can charge.
Right. I'm not that good a planner.
Well, you know, I thought it was interesting. So General Motors announced this week that after about 6 years, they finally sold 100,000 volts. So doesn't that say something about the acceptance of some of this technology? Which, I mean, because I think the Volt is a great car. I mean, that mm-hmm. that you use gasoline when the battery runs out, and so you just keep going. So you could take it up here without a problem.
And you can get about a 50-mile range, a pure electric, in the current generation one. But yeah, remember the first year it came out, Dan Ackerson was the CEO of the company. He said, we're going to sell 80,000 of these year one.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting, you know, because all the surveys and everything, when, you know, they ask the public, is fuel economy important to you? You bet it is.
Yeah.
Would you pay more for a car that would get better fuel? Oh, absolutely. Would you consider buying an electric or a hybrid? Absolutely, I would consider it. And then they go into the showroom and they go, I want the premium sound system and the heated seats. And, this engine's more powerful. I'll take that, too.
Right.
Plus, remember, you know, the average age of the vehicle on the road today is 11.5. I checked this with IHS Polk just before I came here. And if you're trading in a car that's 7, 10 years old, you are going to get this immediate fuel economy boost because of all the development that's
right,
been done.
Compared so to you what don't you need had, abs- it
exactly,
seems great.
Exactly. So you don't need this very high level of fuel economy.
In fact, that's what, another reason why I think people are buying so many crossovers is, does it get as good a fuel economy as the sedan? No. But in most cases, it will get within around 4 miles to the gallon. In some cases, the difference, depending on your engine selection, may only be 1 mile per gallon difference.
Right.
And they're like, well, I'm going for what I want,
exactly.
Not just what's the best label, EPA label.
Right. One of the things that drives me nuts about the media that doesn't cover automotive all the time is they always put gas-guzzling SUVs, and that drives me nuts because that's just not what they are anymore.
Oh, some guzzle, come on.
Some. There's some out there still, but, you know, a lot of them.
Yeah, but they never describe large luxury sedans like an S-Class or a 7 Series as a gas guzzler. And guess what? In a lot of cases, they don't even get as good a fuel economy as some of the SUVs.
Right.
But you know what? You can afford to buy one of those things.
It don't matter.
It don't matter.
Exactly.
You know, if you have to ask the price, it ain't for you.
Right. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So what else do you think is going to come up here? What other buzz? Yeah.
Well, you know, you sat in on the sales projection, so there's some good stuff there. And, you know, as we shoot the show, we're getting the July sales. I think tomorrow that'll be the big buzz in the conference here.
And we think we saw a lot of shopping on our sites early over the 4th of July holiday, and then it just flattened out. And we're going to start seeing months this year that aren't as good as last year, whether it comes out ahead or behind last year.
From what you guys have analyzed, do you think that the year is going to end like last year or better as early had, you know, predicted?
We're seeing shopping down, so that gives us a little bit of pause. We think it's really touch and go as to whether it'll surpass next.
But I come back to last year was the all-time record in the history of the industry, and if we're off a little bit from that, is it really
that's bad? I agree with you completely. It's not disaster. But we are seeing bad practices.
Bad practices, yeah. They're losing their discipline.
Exactly. And we're going to see how disciplined they are through the second half. I mean, will they cut production if inventories get too high because they are climbing?
Yeah.
And everybody's in different positions in that.
But, you know, are the inventories climbing of vehicles that are truly in demand? I mean, so Alan Beatty, president of General Motors last week, North America, was talking about how, for example, that they don't have a sufficient number of CT6s, nor do they have a sufficient number of XT5s.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, but he's saying that, you know,
no,
we could sell more,
but
we just don't have the cars. You know,
that's
Honda has been, defying gravity in terms of the sales of sedans, of the aforementioned Civic of the Accord. I mean, they keep going up. And, you know, so again,
it's a mixed bag.
Where the demand are, you know, it's these vehicles that nobody really wants that you're going to have inventory issues.
To some degree. I mean, and GM, remember, got kind of a production cut when it had to close plants because of they're missing that part that came from Japan due to the earthquake. So they had some, you know, production adjustments.
So just in case everybody wonders what that school bell in the background is about, it's the end of the break session at the conference.
Back to class.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, and you're seeing the bloated inventories are mostly around small cars. Fiat's got the biggest inventories right now.
So speaking of that, I mean, so FCA had some issues in terms of reporting the sales. I mean, I read it. I can't figure out what is.
Well,
what is
we did
the deal?
A little bit of analysis. It looks like the retail stuff doesn't look like it was out of line, but based on their reinstatement of their numbers,
it was like 0.7% off.
But there were some fleet sales discrepancies. But we'll see. They've got a lawsuit against them from some dealers who say.
Well, remember, they've been bragging unbroken chain of every month sales.
And it turns
going
out that ended in 2013, I think it was.
Yeah, September 2013.
And that's where they're going to get in trouble, because it can be argued that they kept saying how sales were good to keep the price of the stock up.
Right.
And they lied through their teeth.
Right.
That's where they're going to get nailed on this.
Right. So I.
So
worrisome days ahead for Fiat.
So now they're going to recalculate the way they report their numbers, and I couldn't completely understand that at all.
Well, and then there's some, you know, they there's some issue around they sell a car, but then they unwind that sale. You know, there's it's kind of complicated.
It's voodoo.
But it's always been fuzzy math around some, you know, sales accounting. And not everybody counts them the same way. Some count them in transit. Others do not. So,
well, the real thing to do is look at production. How many cars get made? Because I can assure you they do not disassemble them and send the parts back to the suppliers at the end of the year.
But remember, there's only estimates on some of those production. Not all the car companies give their production numbers anymore. A lot of that is estimated. So there's not, yeah.
So there is some room for fudging things.
I think so. So another one of those bad practices.
Well, I got to talk about, I'm moderating one of the sessions this afternoon because you had asked about what do you think's coming out of the conference. And it's all on corporate culture.
Oh, interesting.
In the sense of this, as I talked about earlier, everyone complains they can't get the talent they need.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned, everyone's stealing the top talent from each other. So how do you keep people, especially younger people, especially millennials, how do you keep them in your company? And so a couple of things that they're looking at is, do people love where they work? And here's a real fine line in determining your corporate culture. Will your employees recommend to their friends that they should come work there? And then when you get down to corporate culture, one of the discussions is going to be is, what the hell is corporate culture anyway? So one of the guys in preparing for this said, corporate culture is when you take a new hire out to lunch and you tell them in the strictest of confidence what they really have to do to get ahead in that company. He said, that's the corporate culture.
We pay a lot of attention to corporate culture at Cox Automotive because it's family run and there's just...
And you love it there.
I love it there. And, you know, certain people don't fit that culture. But I was listening to a panel. We had one of our executives on a panel, the Ernst & Young women's panel last night. And one of the women made an interesting remark. Would this be a corporate culture that you would want your son or daughter to work in? And I think that's a real, and she was saying that should be the test for upper management in terms of how your company operates.
You raise an interesting point, though, about, John, how you keep millennials. And, you know, it seems to me that everything that I've read is that millennials don't think they're going to work at a company for their entire careers. Millennials think that they will basically work someplace for 5 or 6 years and move on. And this is an industry that has historically had lifers, right?
Right.
I mean, and that people... So how does the auto industry deal with the fact that there...
And it needs to deal with
that. There is this whole group of people that are coming in who have no intention of getting a gold watch or whatever it is that they get at the end of 30, 40 years.
Well, and I can speak to that, and it came up in this panel last night. I mean, you have to sit down with people and talk to them about their career path, and I don't think a lot of companies are very good at that. What do you want to do? What are your strengths? What do you want to be doing?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of us are very good at that.
Well, we'll learn more this afternoon, or certainly I will.
Yes, you will.
Hey, with that, we ought to wrap this up. Michelle Kretz, thanks so much for coming over. This is really great having you on the show again.
Always fun.
Cool. And Gary, you and I will be back anyway.
We will.
Real good. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.